Hello, this is The New World, a podcast produced by Reaction, exploring the world after the coronavirus crisis. I'm Jack Dickens, international editor at Reaction. The world economy has been dealt a hammer blow by the coronavirus pandemic. Everywhere, growth has been sent into freefall. At the same time, sovereign debts have risen alongside doubts about the security of global supply chains. But does rebuilding the economy after the crisis now present us with opportunities as well as problems? And what will our economies look like after the pandemic? With me to discuss these questions on the podcast today are Douglas Alexander, former Secretary of State for International Development and a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, and Maggie Pagano, executive editor at Reaction. So Douglas, I really want to start by asking you, is this crisis going to dramatically reshape economies across the world?
My sense is it will have a profound impact. I was looking at the borrowing figures here in the United Kingdom earlier this morning. We will now be borrowing during 2020 somewhere between £350 and £360 billion. That's about 18% of our GDP. And at the time of the global financial crisis, we were only borrowing about 10%. So the level of borrowing that we're now seeing from governments is pretty unprecedented in peacetime and is more akin to the level of borrowing we last saw during the Second World War. That's just one OECD country, but in countries around the world, there is going to be very significant levels of indebtedness. Secondly, I would observe, we're actually probably closer to the beginning of this crisis than to the end of this crisis. And in that sense, we are speaking today in circumstances where governments are still focused on immediate crisis response rather than the broader reset to their economies that they know will follow this crisis moving forward. But yes, I would certainly agree that we are living through transformative times. The character of the post-crisis world is still up for negotiation. We could have what Yuval Harari, the Israeli historian, has described as a network of fortresses after this crisis. If you like, more closed economies, a greater emphasis on protectionism, a further collapse in multilateralism, or alternatively, the shared experience of both the health and the economic effects of COVID-19 could lead to a rebirth of a greater commitment to multilateralism and cooperation. That will be the very stuff of politics in many of our countries in the years ahead.
And you mentioned this deluge of debt that we're now facing, not only in the United Kingdom, but across the world. I think that according to the US Treasury's latest statistics, the US deficit is higher than ever at about $860 billion. Maggie, what I want to ask you is this debt going to be one of the key features of politics after the crisis?
I think that it's absolutely center stage. It's really how countries treat the debt management that will see us through. We've already had early discussions here about whether there should be some sort of debt jubilee, a way of packaging this debt, as Douglas said, really these debt levels we haven't seen since the Second World War. And maybe in a sense, they've got to be treated like that. And we should have a COVID fund, if you like, packaged up. That's one way of dealing with it. But I think the most important thing is that at the moment, governments are and central banks are still in crisis mode. They're borrowing like there's no tomorrow. And you've seen what the EU is about to launch, a sort of couple of trillion pounds pandemic recovery fund. The truth is nobody really knows. But perhaps essential is that they start talking about how we get it out. And I think there are two things, again, Douglas, you highlighted, these two tensions. One is fortress countries closing down. But at the same time, we perhaps need to have more cooperation. And we've seen that perhaps in the way that international companies are working on vaccines. So you've got these two tensions going on, you know, the way the GSK with other international companies, that's shown that, you know, we're not going to be totally protectionist. There are two tensions there. But going back to the debt, I think that we've got through the emergency. The next stage is how we handle that debt. And that's still up for grabs.
And so building on this, Douglas, this idea of, you know, the threat of these fortresses forming, is dealing with all these issues going to be, when it comes down to the crunch, an issue for nation states? Or is there also a very important global policy response that needs to be conducted? And what would that look like?
it seems to me that one of the features of the coronavirus crisis has been to reveal pre-existing trends and then accelerate them. And if you like, one of the significant geopolitical contests preceding February of 2020 was the rise of China and the strategic contest between the United States and China to be the anchoring power of the 21st century. That has only been amplified and accelerated by what we've lived through in the last 3 or 4 months. And to that extent, that is, if you like, the underpinning reality against which the degree of cooperation and competition will emerge in the international order in the months and years ahead. And here, I think we face a major inflection point in November with either the re-election of Donald Trump or the election of Joe Biden as President of the United States. Because it seems to me that if either of those individuals are elected, that contest between the United States and China for the anchoring power of the 21st century will continue, but they will take very different approaches. I think if Joe Biden is elected president, there will be areas in which the United States and China will compete fiercely, but there will also be carve-out areas of cooperation, global public goods, if you like, areas like climate change, probably coronavirus response, as Maggie was describing, in terms of the development of drugs, potentially other areas like cybercrime and other issues of common concern. In contrast, I think if Donald Trump were to be re-elected, we would see a continued deterioration in the international order. And if you like, the extent to which the multilateral system has just not shown up in the last 3 or 4 months, the Security Council never discussed coronavirus in January or February or March or April of this year, or the failure of international institutions to address this problem adequately, isn't so much a feature of the multilateral system as the extent to which politics is changing within that system. And if we see a continued affirmation of a kind of xenophobic populist nationalism that we've seen from Modi, we've seen from Duterte, we've seen from Trump, and to an extent we've seen from Xi Jinping in Beijing, then actually it will be very difficult to see more coordination, and you're much more likely to see that outcome of a network of fortresses. So I think a great deal hangs on what happens in the United States in early November as to whether we have a future of competition and cooperation, or simply a future of competition in the immediate years ahead in the international system.
Maggie, unpicking some of the things that Douglas has raised there, is there also another side to this? Is the Trump revolution as dramatic as we think it is in practice, as well as in terms of the rhetoric that we often see from President Trump on Twitter, etc.? Is there an extent to which our global supply chains are now so important, we're so hooked on globalization, that even another Trump presidency won't entirely unravel all of these threads and networks?
There's never one answer to a question like that, Jack, but I think that there are certain sectors of all our economies across Western Europe where we've found ourselves very vulnerable. And it's down to sort of basics like the PPE equipment, the fact that 90% of, you know, Britain's equipment came from China, and basically, you know, there were no contingency plans available. I think that we're going to see onshoring in specific areas like that. I also think, and we've already seen it in terms of inward investment and takeovers post Huawei, there are going to be other repercussions on Chinese involvement with British business. You say the Trump revolution. Do you mean his war with China?
Yes, I mean essentially his more abrasive unilateral approach to trade and his desire to take on China and bring things back on shore into the United States, even before the pandemic hit, essentially.
I mean, the problem with Trump is that he often says what other people are thinking, but they don't dare express it in quite the way that he's done. I mean, China's involvement across Europe, owning many ports, some of the most important strategic industries across North Africa, Italy, Europort, you know, China's investment in Western Europe and Africa is deeply worrying. And even if Biden does get in, I would have thought that actually he's also going to be very, very careful.
Douglas, where does all this leave the case for free trade and free commerce and enterprise? Are we entering a phase of world history? Essentially, you seem to suggest that November is very significant, but in a wider context, are we entering a phase where protectionism is becoming more normal?
Let's first of all look at how we've got to where we are. I think it's fair to recognize that even before this crisis, we were living through a crisis of multilateralism. If you look back to the first G7 meeting that Donald Trump attended after being elected president in 2016, there was notionally a dispute about trade policy at that Canadian-hosted G7 meeting. The reality was, however, the dispute wasn't about trade. It was about an orientation towards the international system. The G7 historically has been a high-trust institution in which it is presumed that leaders work towards global public goods. Donald Trump's actually a low-trust politician. That's why he's most comfortable working with autocrats, because they speak the same language and understand the same issues. Secondly, he self-defines as an interest-based politician, not a values-based politician. America first. So again, he's comfortable with an India first, Russia first approach. The idea that there are common values underpinning the multilateral system is a foreign language to him. So in that sense, I absolutely agree with Maggie that many of these trends preceded Trump. But I think one of the most significant changes we've witnessed in Washington in recent years has been the extent to which Trump's hostility towards China has become a cross-party view as to the reality of the strategic threat facing the United States. So we're not actually simply looking at a trade war, we're looking at a tech war, and if we're not very careful, quite possibly a second Cold War, in the sense that Ian Bremmer at the Eurasia Group has written about this, we're witnessing a very significant decoupling. And in that sense, that affects tech companies, because if you look at the markets in which they were planning to operate at the time of the millennium, they were presuming a global footprint for their businesses. They now see the world bifurcated between a Chinese sphere of influence with a whole different set of standards, regulation, and national players, and the rest of the world. So in that sense, I think we are witnessing a significant decoupling that extends beyond trade policy in the years ahead. How will trade policy be affected? Well, first of all, look at the WTO. I know that the director generalship is open for candidates at the moment, but the WTO basically has become at best a dispute resolution mechanism rather than a forum in which these negotiations take place. So I think that COVID will only amplify and accelerate the view of at least a number of major countries that protectionism, national champions, and that more strategic view that Maggie was describing is the way of the future. Take the example that she cited of PPE, or more broadly of pharmaceuticals during the crisis. There's no doubt that most countries will not want to be in a position of dependency with China that they found themselves in the early months of this year. So again, I think the real question is, where is the boundary drawn between strategic national interests and broader international trade? If it is limited, let's say, to PPE, to ventilators, to pharmaceuticals, I think most governments will embrace that approach. I think other governments will go significantly beyond that and actually imperil the very idea of the extended supply chains that have been so critical to the rise in global prosperity that we've witnessed over the last 20 or 30 years.
I'm glad you mentioned the national champions issue, because the idea here is that Chancellor Angela Merkel, President Macron in France want to create these European companies which can have a kind of state backing so they can compete with the state-backed companies in China. Is this something we should be worried about?
Well, it's interesting. We've just obviously seen the British government reverse its position on Huawei. And unusually, the Americans don't have a major player in that space. The alternatives to Huawei are widely judged to be Ericsson and Nokia, two major European players. But if you look at the tech space more broadly, Europe feels a significant deficiency when it looks at the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Apples and the Microsofts of this world relative to the absence of equivalent players on the European stage. So my sense again is this will come down to political judgments as to whether the ambition for national champions extends beyond the scope of those kind of issues that we were discussing, pharmaceuticals, ventilators, PPE, and reaches more broadly into the economy. I think one useful device to understand where we are is to think of the analogy of a wartime economy. Not only are we seeing unprecedented levels of public expenditure at the moment pooled internationally to try and find a scientific remedy to this conflict with the virus, with all the money being spent on vaccinations, but I think there are two or three other parallels that it's useful in understanding when we try and chart the way ahead. Firstly, I think, notwithstanding all of those efforts to find a vaccine or even therapeutic treatments, the COVID business as usual scenario is going to last a lot longer than people realize. This is a process and not an event. Let's remember back in 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm told the German public it was likely the German troops would be home before the leaves fell that autumn. The reality is, I think it is only slowly dawning on people how profound a challenge to our economies this health shock is. Secondly, however, though, wartime economies develop winners as well as losers. It's not universally negative. And while we've seen internationally companies like the Ford Motor Company repurpose their plants to deliver ventilators, there's going to be significant sector dispersion. Some sectors are going to do very well and some are going to do very badly as we move through this crisis. But thirdly, and most critically, government becomes a much bigger actor in wartime economies. And I think not simply for reasons of debt levels that we've been discussing, but more broadly, the strategic ambitions of government, it is likely that we're moving towards a sustained period when we're going to see government as a much bigger actor in the economy than we saw over the last 20 to 30 years.
Thank you for moving us on quite nicely there from the geopolitical situation to the question of winners and losers within countries and within nation states. Maggie, what I want to ask you about this is there also an element of creative destruction at play? The idea that even though this is a crisis, as Rahm Emanuel once said, you don't want to let it go to waste. And there are some opportunities for businesses here too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's perhaps a bit tragic to talk about opportunity out of a crisis, but that is human nature. And we've seen it already in the first few weeks and months of lockdown, how some businesses were closed overnight, but within days they were up and running again in very creative ways. It's far too early to give a good prognosis, but there will be industries, for example, the airline industry, which has been devastated. I think probably that is an industry that for the long term is going to be damaged, but we've seen it with tech, Zoom, the incredible technology that has sort of emerged during this crisis. Businesses responding, pharmaceuticals, life sciences, biotech, people working with apps. They don't always work, but test and trace, you know. So we're going to see a lot of new development.
And do you think, Maggie, there's a danger in a sense that the government, from an understandable perspective, goes for the comforting option and tries for too long to protect too many jobs which just don't exist anymore, when it should be pivoting towards these new sectors which are perhaps firing after the crisis?
I think that what they did immediately at the start of the lockdown to protect jobs was the right thing to do. There was no other way of doing that. What we're bound to see once the furloughing and other job retention schemes unfold, they're bound to be huge job losses. But I don't think it's not the job of government to protect those jobs forever. And what they do need to do is to create an environment in which people who are laid off can set up their own businesses, because as we know, small businesses are the future of the economy. They are where the growth is going. So in that sense, and this is Mariana Mazzucato's view, you know, the state has to be an enabler, a facilitator. And they've got to, you know, whether that is making it more attractive for people to invest in companies, whether that is, you know, helping small companies with loans. There are many ways that the state can help. And hopefully, Rishi Sunak understands that. I think that's his next big test, actually.
So, Douglas, what is the right balance moving forward between the state and the private sector? How do we wind down these furlough schemes, not only in the UK, but also in the US, without causing a tremendous amount of pain?
Well, firstly, let me echo Maggie's point about it being a very early stage in the crisis to offer definitive judgments. I commend the government for the immediate action that was taken. I served in the British cabinet during the financial crisis. Honestly, what that taught you was a couple of things. Firstly, it's essential to understand the character of the crisis. To Alistair Darling's credit, to Gordon Brown's credit, I think they understood earlier than many that the essential character of the global financial crisis was one of solvency, not of liquidity for the banks, and acted decisively and rapidly to protect the integrity of the financial system that was otherwise vulnerable to collapse. Similarly, I think it's important for politicians to recognise we will not find an economic remedy to this crisis until we find a health remedy. That the core of this problem, crisis, difficulty that we're living through is the absence of a vaccine or therapeutic treatment that will sustain and build back levels of demand. So where do we find ourselves several months in? The government's taken necessary and important remedial action, but the truth is they are triaging a very difficult situation, and it's unclear for how long we will be in a position where we are seeing levels of demand suppressed by the psychological effects and the health effects of the virus itself. What do I think then are the next steps? I think firstly, we need to understand that this is a crisis on an unprecedented scale. When we were in the cabinet in 2008, 2009, we were so busy dealing with the immediate crisis response that, hand on heart, none of us were aware the extent to which that event would churn and change both economics and politics over the longer term, say over the following decade. I think that's likely to be the case in the cabinet room today, that actually this is a profoundly significant disruptive effect and impact on our economy and on our way of life, and it's very hard to see through that longer lens. A few initial thoughts, though. Firstly, complacency is our enemy, not our friend. After the financial crisis, the two sectors that were most effective in pulling people into the labour market in the UK was the hospitality sector and the retail sector. And those are two sectors that have been differentially hammered by the virus. So in that sense, I would be urging very active labour market policies from the government in the months ahead, because we saw in the 1980s that an unmanaged transition from one balance of economy to a separate balance of economy comes at very significant human cost and also longer-term economic scarring effects. So I'd be arguing for active labour market policies. And secondly, I do think it's important to identify which are those sectors that are going to prosper in the longer term, whether that's e-commerce infrastructure, whether that's the reshoring and domestication of supply chains we were talking about, whether that is logistics. There are a whole range of economies and sectors of the economy that are going to do well. Part of the challenge for government is not only supporting individuals in that transition, but also recognising how they can provide appropriate support to ensure that the United Kingdom is a winner and not a loser when it comes to those new dynamic sectors.
Maggie, in all this, is there a danger that moving forward we will take low interest rates and low inflation for granted?
Absolutely. And I think that is the great danger. And the great debate at the moment, I think, within the Bank of England and the Treasury is, you know, to what extent do you allow negative interest rates? I think about a fifth of all gilts at the moment are actually yielding negative rates. So it's very dangerous. Of course, there could be some inflation coming through, but it's hard to see how oil prices, petrol, food, I can't imagine that we're going to get much inflation. No, I suspect, and I'd be interested in Douglas's view on this, is whether there's some sort of special purpose vehicle of COVID debt, if you like, is created and pushed out to the long term so that we can get back to some sort of normality. But can I just pick up on something that Douglas said about the 1980s? And I think rather than the financial crash, what we're going through now, we have more lessons to learn from the 80s than the crash. The crash was something quite different in a sense. And the great fear that we don't go through a sort of deindustrialization. Then it was manufacturing that was hit. Now it's going to be the softer industries, retail, hospitality. But yet there could be opportunities there. Go back to PPE and other goods that we need here. Maybe we're going to see some sort of renaissance in manufacturing. But if we're going to have that, then governments have got to put far more resources into stem cells, FE, and make sure that the young are being properly skilled up, which I believe the government is trying to do, but they'll need to do that at speed.
Do you have something to add there, Douglas?
Well, firstly, I fear that we're about to be hit by a tidal wave of joblessness. You know, we saw last week announcements from John Lewis, from GE, from Boots, from Burger King. I fear those are just the earliest announcements of what's going to be a very, very significant number of job losses as we move through the autumn. And in that sense, I think in terms of the balance of risk, the right approach from the government is to spend what it takes at the moment, because the greater risk is that certain sections of the economy simply don't come back sufficiently to help us service the debt than the immediate risk of borrowing going up at the moment. I mean, the truth is, with interest rates at their present level, the cost of borrowing is not as material a consideration for the government as the fragility that carrying higher levels of debt will be into the years ahead. Firstly, just by way of comparison, before the financial crisis, we were about 40% debt to GDP ratio in the UK. After the financial crisis, about 80%. after this crisis, I would expect we're going to be above 100% debt to GDP ratio. So it's important to recognise when it comes to what is the appropriate fiscal and monetary stance of the government, it's not going to be paid for anytime soon. The reality is we're going to be borrowing enormous amounts of money. We are at the moment borrowing enormous amounts of money, and we're never going to pay it back immediately. It's going to become part of the national debt. So the real question is, how do you service significantly enhanced levels of public debt? And in that regard, while borrowing is cheap, that's much less of a problem than if you look a few years hence, where either you're in circumstances where if the economic recovery goes badly, we don't have sufficient taxes to service that debt, or if the economy takes off, we could see significant levels of inflation or indeed interest rates simply rising with the result that the cost of servicing that debt goes up. So I think the Chancellor faces some pretty sharp and difficult choices when it comes to both the spending review and the budget that he will set out in November. And again here, my sense is the politics and the economics are somewhat in tension. As a politician, he will want to be imposing tax rises earlier in the Parliament rather than later. But on the other hand, given the fragility of the economy, the fact we're in a process rather than having experienced an event, that would weigh against the immediate imposition of tax rises. So I think there's a potential for the kind of special purpose vehicle, and I know that there's much economic commentary on it at the moment. I was listening to David McWilliams, the Irish economist, last week making exactly that case. Whether it's through a special purpose vehicle or whether it's through the standard borrowing mechanisms, the truth is the United Kingdom is going to have a significantly higher level of public debt for the foreseeable future. And the question for policymakers is, how do we mitigate the risks associated with that while trying to secure a more balanced economic recovery?
And Maggie, at risk of getting you to say the obvious, perhaps, where does this leave the kind of Thatcher-Reagan economic orthodoxy that was not only important before the global financial crisis, but also to an extent persisted afterwards?
Well, I think the whole notion of free markets and capitalism, as it has been practiced, or as it has been over the last 20 years, was already under threat pre-COVID. We've had, as you know, Jack, I'm a great critic of what I would call managerial capitalism. We've had, obviously, there are fewer poorer people today than there have been before. But what has happened is we've got this tremendous concentration of wealth at the very top, and that's been under threat. And we're going to see, I mean, if we have levels of unemployment that are being predicted, 3-4 million in Britain, be the same across Europe and elsewhere, you're going to potentially have, you know, a lot of civil unrest. Don't want to be too gloomy about it, but you could see that. And people will be seeing that the youngsters and the middle classes will have no capital. And that is something that is really, in a sense, I would say the real challenge for governments is how you redistribute this wealth. And my own analysis is that we need to find a way of spreading it, whether it's employee share ownership schemes, sharing bonuses. I don't know, there needs to be a new way of looking at the proceeds of most corporates. As Ray Dalio in the States says, capitalists don't know how to divide the pie and the socialists don't know how to bake it. We need to find a sort of middle way.
So Dougie, is there a chance for this kind of middle way now after the crisis?
Yes, as I said, after the financial or during the financial crisis, I don't think any of us adequately understood the extent to which the after effects of that crisis would churn and change politics. And my sense is this will be a historic event in reshaping our politics. One question mark is whether it represents, if you like, a circuit breaker to a decade of populism and nationalism. You know, the politics of anger has had a very bad crisis. Look at Donald Trump, look at Boris Johnson, look at Bolsonaro in Brazil. But it's unclear as to quite yet what the contours of that new politics will look like. I agree with Maggie that capitalism was in crisis before coronavirus. This is a virus that differentially affects the old, but the economic effects of this virus differentially affect the young. And in that sense, I'm not at all surprised that there are not many cheerleaders for capitalism amongst a generation of young people who have no capital. And in that sense, I think that the coronavirus crisis has thrown an unsparing lens on the inequality that was a hallmark of the United Kingdom and many OECD countries before this crisis. So what could or should the future look like? I would argue that capitalism does need politics to help solve the problem. I think the market is a peerless mechanism for generating wealth, but has been evidenced as a hopeless mechanism for distributing that wealth. And in some ways, the capitalists need to be saved from themselves. Because if we continue to see an ever higher proportion of the wealth generated going to the upper echelons of society, the public consent on which a market economy relies disintegrates. And in that sense, I do think that there is a heavy burden of responsibility on policymakers to come up with a suite of new policies adequate to the scale of the challenge that the post-crisis world will reveal. Now, whether that is labour market policies, whether that is policies in relation to the economy, whether that is simply the recognition that the virus has reminded us all about our shared vulnerability and the requirement for better social care or for a strong and effective health service, my instinct tells me that we will see a larger state in the years ahead. But equally, you could construct a scenario whereby if we've seen a politics characterized by anger before this crisis, given the bow wave of unemployment and the inequality that this crisis threatens, we could see yet more politics of anger in the years ahead. So I think the key political battle, in addition to the policy discussions we've been having, is who frames the post-crisis common sense. And my hope would be that there would be a recognition of the need for greater equality and greater sustainability in our economy in the years ahead as that common sense takes shape.
And this emphasis upon sustainability and the environment is something you've written about recently, Douglas. And I was just wondering whether you could expand on this question of whether this is a chance as well to pivot our economies towards combating climate change while also boosting growth.
Well, many people have written that the climate crisis is the same as the COVID crisis. And there's one fundamental difference. In a pandemic, you have a peak level of infections. In a climate crisis, there isn't a peak level of climate crisis. The system basically spirals away from you. And in that sense, I think there are important lessons recognizing that difference. First of all, it is much more expensive to act later than at an early stage. If you imagine the steps that could and should have been taken in the earliest months of this year and the cost that's been borne by the economy because those steps were not taken, I think that's analogous to the challenge of climate change. Secondly, it's been a salutary reminder that science matters. Despite the tweets of Donald Trump or the speeches of Bolsonaro in Brazil, the reality is the path of the disease has been inexorable. And similarly, you can't argue with maths or with physics. And the truth is, Mother Nature is a combination of physics, biology, and chemistry. And in that sense, it's been a salutary reminder that we need to engage with the reality of the risks we are running in relation to the climate. A final point, though, would be that doesn't guarantee that the right choices will be made on climate change. Because actually, as we've seen with coronavirus, certain politicians decide to double down on fantasy rather than double down on science. And in that sense, I think there's a heavy burden of responsibility on policymakers right across the political spectrum to recognize the lessons from the COVID crisis and apply them quickly to the climate crisis. I hope that whether you're on the left or on the right, you will see the opportunity for a reset of the economy to essentially a zero carbon economy as being a way to justify increased public expenditure and at the same time to address the bow wave of unemployment that's coming towards us. And in that sense, I don't think ownership of the climate crisis belongs to any part of the ideological spectrum. It's a responsibility that frankly falls on everybody.
I suppose the irony is that what has happened because of COVID has actually helped the climate crisis, has it not? Because air travel is down, transport is down, people are not moving around. People are talking about skies across India. They could see the Taj Mahal and Himalayas for the first time. I mean, it's sort of ironic, isn't it, that you had to close down the economy, world economy, for people to realize the impact. I do wonder whether we will, and I think what we haven't talked about here is perhaps behavior. At the moment, it seems to me that people are quite paralyzed about getting back to some sort of normal. And I don't know how you move them out of the sort of condition of fear at the moment. I know that's not linked quite to the climate, but if we're talking about getting the economy working again, that seems to me the biggest thing that governments have got to try and sort out.
I see national trust and trust in politicians as a national asset at this time. And it grieves me as a citizen to observe the collapse of trust here in the UK in the quality of leadership that we've witnessed. But I think to try and answer Maggie's question about trust, public leadership is fundamental. And in the absence of public leadership, the public are much more inclined to make their own judgments. And in that sense, I think here in the UK, we've seen a depressing squandering of quite a lot of the levels of trust and hope that were vested in the government at an early stage of this crisis. But on Maggie's broader point, let's take air travel. Effectively, the airline industry around the world is bust at the moment. That model just doesn't work. There's going to be a need for significant public support for the airline industry to get it back on its feet. And in any democracy, it's reasonable to set conditions on public financial support. Why would we want to reset the airline industry back to where we were in January or February? And that's why, if you look, for example, at the steps that the French government have taken in relation to Air France and KLM, I expect that to be a standard for others. We'll be looking at things like fuel mandates, energy mandates, as the price exacted for the public support that will be offered. And actually, as Maggie said, that's not just true in the transport sector, that's true in many of the heavy emitting sectors of the economy. And in that sense, I think there's a real opportunity for a very fertile discussion about how, in the terminology of the debate at the moment, we can build back better and not simply provide public support to return to some of the high carbon practices we saw before this crisis, but instead see this as an opportunity for a more fundamental reset.
Maggie, just as a final point on that, do you think there will be this kind of temptation, especially in the struggling Eurozone states such as certain parts of France, Italy, and Spain, to build back with the sort of heavy carbon jobs that were there before, rather than trying to generate new sorts of industries for people who've become unemployed by this crisis?
That's a good question. I mean, the French tend to look after themselves, don't they? I think that people have seen how vulnerable and how fragile, actually, the whole sort of chain of human interaction is out of this. And they will look to protect jobs. So if it means turning on, you know, the big manufacturing plants, they'll probably continue. But it is a great opportunity to try something new and innovative. And as we've seen, the starting point for this discussion was creative destruction. I'm sure there'll be new energies. Already people are talking about hydrogen with the same sort of energy that they were talking about, you know, other inventions. People will, I'm sure, gravitate to look at new solutions. So hopefully positive things will emerge from this.
And finally, one question I'd like to pose to both of you while we're rounding up the podcast is, one of the potential dangers for all governments at a time of crisis is that they put in place measures to remedy that crisis, which then later exacerbates the next crisis. So what are the things we're not looking at right now and that we need to be very careful about moving forwards?
My immediate thought was social care and how we look after and treat the elderly in this country, which I think has been a scandal for decades. It's been a cross-party consensus that it was a sector that needs looking after, but neither side, left nor right, has really approached it. When Theresa May, you have to sort of say, hey, at least she did try and have a go, but nobody was prepared to have the debate. I hope we have the debate. As we know, most of the sector is actually privately owned. It's not as well looked after and as it should be. And I think the way that the care homes, I mean, only half the care homes have been badly hit, but the way that a lot of them were so badly hit is tragic. And the government's got to tackle this, and it's got to be on a cross-party basis. And I don't know what the answer is, whether it's that people will have to sell their homes to pay for it, I'm not sure, or the NHS has to take on the cost, you know, whether there's a way of including the two budgets, I'm not sure. But I do think that that's what we've seen as the most vulnerable.
I would agree social care is an urgent priority. I saw my parents for the first time last week. They both reside in a care home. First time I'd seen them in many months. The care that they have received from the staff in that care home has been literally priceless. Mm. And yet the value that we attach to a lot of care workers' tasks is valueless. You know, why are they some of the lowest paid people in society when for all of us, the care and support of our elderly parents should be a very overarching and high priority? So I hope that this crisis affords us the opportunity to look anew at not just the social care sector, but how we offer both remuneration and esteem to people who choose to work in the high touch sectors of the economy, as well as the high tech sectors of the economy. I suppose the second observation I would make would be the speed and character of the recovery is not yet determined. That is up for debate and decision. And it is never too early to start those debates and to frame those reforms. I'm reading a new book at the moment, The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, the story of Winston Churchill's first year in Downing Street. And it's a brilliant evocation of life during the Blitz in London. But it's a salutary reminder that even as the bombs were falling, the Beveridge report was being undertaken. We didn't wait until the end of the war to decide what the character of a new settlement, a welfare state fit for heroes, would look like. And in that sense, I would be nervous if either within government or within broader civil society, we took a view that said, these are really important questions, but not now. Let's just focus on the crisis response. I think now is a time to be undertaking that deep thinking, preparing those plans for reform, debating and discussing them, because the reality is, I think this is an event of such seismic effect and consequence for all of us that there's going to be a need for exactly that kind of fresh thinking and new settlement.
Douglas should be chairman of that commission.
Good suggestion, I think. Well, with that stirring call to action, thank you very much, Douglas and Maggie. That's all we have time for today.